the Corbusier comes straight out of the technicity of the 18th century Enlightenment. His first drawing of a cube is great housing project of the Unité d'Habitation. The same imagination constructs, like God, behind nature, like Newton found out, in geometry, and you will construct man in a rational way. Others said, well, maybe you don't even have to construct. Maybe you can just find. Here is Duchamp's objet trouvé. He called it a fountain. And maybe even you don't have to go to the lengths of a Dadaist in order to shock, in order to provoke, in order to re-see our universe. You can be like those great fortune covers of the 1930s and see the universe as it actually is, mechanical, technical, operative, and its forms, the forms produced by the machine, may themselves be beautiful. My friend Jim Sterling in England consistently builds machines. All over the landscape of England, building by Jim Sterling, nothing more or less like great machines evacuating air, pulling in cool air and pushing out hot air, like the great landscape of Cape Canaveral that he was so enamored of when he visited it in the early 60s. This is architecture which is no longer, in a sense, looking to other canons outside of building for its artistry, but saying, let's imitate the machine as hermetically and as closely and as crisply as possible, and then maybe we can come close to the world of production and consumption that we find in the end so alienating, and then maybe we can overcome it. Others in this present world don't like to do that. They say machines are still technique. Technique is still dominant. Domination is power, power is politics, politics, and so on and so forth. The whole gamut of technicity is rejected by these two architects, Peter Eisenman here and Michael Graves there. Michael Graves, who tries to make architecture painting, Peter Eisenman, who tries to make architecture pure structure. In both painting and pure structure, the empty cave, if you like, that can only be inhabited by someone who chooses to crawl in but is not actually designed for the person who is in it, or the painting, the entry through planes after planes after planes, as if you were going through canvas after canvas after canvas. In the retreat of these two architects from building, from technicity, they are saying that between the art and the building in architecture, we will take the art and we will stand aside from that production that organizes society in building. Adolf Loos, at the end of his life, the man who designed those first two images you saw at the beginning of the lecture, summed it up very clearly. He said, in this world, it is impossible to see that architecture can be in anything but a tomb and a monument. All the rest is building. Building well, building soundly, thinking well about society, and building well for that society. Architecture, the high spiritual art of architecture, can only be in something that is useless, something that has no functional purpose, something that expresses only itself. And he made for himself this tomb, and he drew this particular tomb on his deathbed, Adolf Loos, on a cube. This is his expression, in the end, of the death of architecture in our own time. Another architect, Aldo Rossi, an Italian architect of enormous perception, as much perception I think is very much influenced by Adolf Loos, who has been building rooms like this in Italy for the last 10 or 15 years. Quiet rooms, rooms where man can contemplate again himself. And yet, they're white rooms, maybe they're also insane asylums, maybe they're also pulpits for preaching, maybe they're altars, maybe, but it's endless, and he knows it's endless, and he knows there is no inherent meaning anymore in one form as opposed to another. That symbolic world has been rent, and architecture, in this famous painting of Aldo Rossi, has been assassinated. If you have questions, that is wonderful. I have very few answers. Maybe we can have a light. If there are questions you feel should be public, I will answer them publicly. And if there are should be private, I will answer them privately. Are there any public questions? Yes? A lion and chicken. I think that is a question of, if you believe it's possible to conceive of architecture as an individual act, projection of your own meaning upon what you're doing, then you can make it. I think that if you think of building as a social act, then I think you can't make it alone. But I think that architecture, in the sense that it was known to be in the Renaissance and even held together in the 18th century, is probably not alive in that way. I think that the art of building probably has to be completely reconceived. And as you reconceive it, so your political and social and aesthetic vision is reconceived. I think it's all been done and all the reconceptions have been made. I don't think there's any new conception about it. In other words, I think you could begin to think of architecture as a social art, William Morris. Architecture as an aesthetic art, Michael Graves. Architecture as a constructive art. Architecture as a service in an industrialized society. Architecture as making machines. In each, you are being, in one way or another, authentic to a subculture in your society. Denise Scott Brown feels that the more people you appeal to in your architecture, the more authenticity your architecture makes. And possibly it reaches out for a civilization which can, in one way or another, embrace a larger number of people. The artist, the pure artist, feels not so strongly ratified by the populace as he is by his own vision. And between those two streams, you know, there's a great gap. Yes?
In one way or another. And as far as the Maori is concerned, the critical division is not between life and death, as we conceive of it, but rather between tupu and mate. The ceasing of the growth, the beginning of the contraction, of the diminishing. Now this links in with a number of Maori habits and customs and ideas, particularly concerning the notion of honor. The Maori, like medieval knights and so on, are people who are very taken with the concept of honor. A man, a woman, a person, but mainly a man, must not allow himself to be insulted and to accept the insult with no retaliation. Because if he does so, that is an implication that his tupu,
his growth, therefore his very being, his very life, is essentially over. He is now forced to accept a diminishment of his status, of his position in society. And so therefore, many wars that were fought among the Maori, and they fought quite a few, were fought because of insults passed between chiefs of tribes, of various vocal groups or what have you. Whether one chief would insult the other, and the other feeling, oh my gosh, my whole tupu, my whole being is threatened, and then would attempt to retaliate, and there would be a war for this purpose. In fact, it's a fairly common thing in Polynesian studies in general, where there is a good deal of warfare, to analyze that warfare according to population pressure. You remember when I showed you the slides of Rapa long ago, there were all those fortified villages up on the mountains, and there was evidence that there was a great deal of warfare going on among these people. And the analysis that seems to present itself most automatically and immediately is, well, population pressure. A lot of people living on a little island, they want to get the land to keep themselves going. A very nice materialistic explanation. But somehow you wonder, you know, if that's really it. The data aren't that solid and that sure to make that conclusion, that analysis, absolutely unequivocal. And it may be, and sometimes I really wonder if it's not, that really it's this more ideological kind of a notion that these people are fighting each other because of their insults and their threats to each other's tupu, and their feeling that if I don't retaliate and now bring all of my retainers and all of my followers with me and retaliate on that guy, I'm essentially dead, and I can't stand that, and so I'm going to go to war. I don't know, but certainly in New Zealand there was no population pressure. You know, New Zealand's a great big country, and there weren't very doggone many Maori down there. And so when they were fighting, they weren't fighting over, got to have the land in order to keep alive, but rather it seems much more to have been the notion of avenging insults. Well, they had a lot of strange ways that they would insult each other. One way, the most strange, was to climb a tree and wait until your rival passed underneath and then urinate on his head. And if you pull that off, then you have put a pretty good insult on him, and he has got to then retaliate by trying to kill you or climb yet a higher tree or something of that sort. Again, the notion is that your tupu, your sense, your life, your being, is localized basically in the head. And so there are all kinds of taboos, all kinds of restrictions and restraints that hedge around behavior of the head. You should not have your head higher, physically higher, than the head of a chief. So you have to come in kind of low on the chief so that their head remains higher than the chiefs of the commoners. That's one reason why they were carried around on the shoulders of their retainers in Tahiti, so that their heads would be higher. Another reason is so their sacred feet wouldn't touch the ground. But anyway, a lot of a person's being was sort of concentrated in his head, and thus anything untoward that happened to your head was a very serious insult and had to be avenged. Okay, well, now, a Maori, or a Polynesian in general, doesn't necessarily live a smooth growth followed by a smooth decline. But rather, if you looked at that line more carefully, you would see that it would have, you know, little setbacks like that, and then on the way down, you have little bits of growth and then decline again and so on. And through the vicissitudes of everyday life, a person is either mate or tupu, either growing definitely or diminishing. And this accounts or is indicative of a certain kind of personality trait or characteristic of Polynesian peoples that was noted by the person whom I'm stealing most of these ideas from, a guy named Johansson, a Dane. I can tell you, incidentally, the book that I'm taking most of these ideas from is by this man, Johansson. It's called The Maori and His Religion in Its Non-Ritualistic Aspects, a book which is a lot more interesting than its title. Anyway, he said that it's characteristic of the Maori that they have periods in their daily lives of great expansion and self-confidence, alternating with periods of depression and fear and anxiety. and their lives don't tend to, you know, just in general behavior and general attitudes and so on, don't tend to stay on the even golden mean, but rather are either very expansive and exciting and so on, or quite depressed. Very interesting, because I noticed this too in Tahiti when I worked there. The Tahitians are a people who vacillate between great joy and singing and happiness and really open kinds of behavior, alternating with depression and contraction and feeling down and kind of curling themselves up into a little ball and feeling that life is really treating them very badly. And it seems to be, again, analyzable in terms of this tupu mate kind of a distinction, where, you know, one day they feel tupu, they really feel their oats and are expressing it, and other days they feel mate, they feel contracted, they feel beat down, and they demonstrate this very much in their daily life. Or again, I don't know if I've mentioned this to you or not, but when I was in Rapa when a hurricane hit, and the people during the hurricane were absolutely paralyzed with terror. They couldn't work, they couldn't do anything. The same way when epidemics come and start to affect the children and some of them die, I think I have mentioned some of that, the people get tremendously afraid, they close their shutters, they go into the houses and they sit there. They can't bring themselves to make meals, they can't bring themselves to do anything but just sit. And it seems to me as if this is, again, an indication of this mate, a sense that their strength is gone, their abilities to cope with the problems and the difficulties that face them are non-existent, and as such, they have this sense of mate, they have this sense of being diminished and being brought down. Okay. Another concept that we need to put together with tupu is mana. Oneness is a term that is used quite a bit now in the English language. Basically, it's this. Tupu is an internal phenomenon. Like a plant, like a seed, the tupu of an individual is his intrinsic potential to become something, to grow, just out of the seeds of development that that person bears within. Mana, on the other hand, refers to the relations between an individual and the rest of the world. The relations how a person can gather in strength or be affected by bad influences, weakening influences from the outside. You see, the basic idea seems to be that the Maori does not conceive of his personality, his self, as bounded by his envelope of skin, but rather it penetrates into the things and the other people around him. There are all kinds of channels of influence passing from each person to the outside, to other people and other things, and from the outside back into the person. It's a rather permeable membrane that separates you from the rest of the world. And as such, there are influences passing through that all the time, and the job is to try to bring yourself into contact with and open yourself to those influences which are beneficial, and to block off those influences which are detrimental. And this whole system of concepts and ideas relating to the passage of influences from the outside to the individual is called mana. Now, to exemplify this in a couple of ways, there is a close tie between the Polynesian and his land. The notion that the land that you own, that you share ownership in, is in a sense a part of your personality. Because somehow you are augmented by your land, and your land is augmented by you, by the various people who own it. For example, if a Maori should die or be wounded in a battle, and death is near, the big job is to get that person back to his land, because it's not right, it's not appropriate for a person to die on the land where on land other than his own. It's as if you die incomplete, because part of you is intrinsically associated with that land, and so upon dying, you should sort of be a whole person, and insofar as you're away from your land, you can't be that. Again, in Rapa now, I'm talking mainly about the New Zealand Maori, of course, but there are a lot of similarities among Polynesians, so I will spill out of New Zealand quite frequently. In Rapa, When people were telling me, you know, they're backbiting, insulting people like anybody else in the world, and they often would, you know, people who were talking to me would tell me how so-and-so is not worth much. He's not a very, you know, he can't read and write. He doesn't have any, any resources to support a family, stuff like that. And they have various little things that they say about each other that are uncomplimentary. But the most uncomplimentary thing that a Rothman can say is that the person is landless. If you want to say somebody is just utterly worthless and not worth it, you say, oh, he owns no land. And that's really about as bad a state of being in Rapa as you can be in. Well, again, the notion that somehow land is a part of a person, so that if you don't have any, you are deficient by that much. And that's quite a bit, as far as the Polynesians are concerned. One other example, this time from Tahiti, they have ghosts, which after death will come and make you sick and kill you. One way to prevent a ghost from harming you is to call in another kind of a ghost. The first kind of a ghost, well, never mind the first kind. The second kind is called a Wadawakina. This is a spirit that is an ancestral spirit that is sort of a protector spirit of a family from time immemorial. And if a ghost of a recently deceased person is attacking you or someone of your family, one way you can do it is to call in the Barawaino to destroy the malignant ghost. There was a family, for example, in which there had been a recent death, and they were gathered around in this house, and as they sat there, they heard doors beginning to open and close in the house, and then rocks were thrown against the roof and against the wall, and they said, oh my gosh, the ghost of the recently deceased is here to cause us trouble. And so the head of the family, who happened to be a woman, stepped outside and called in the old ancestral Wadawaino and said, come on in and help us. And then she went back in the house and they heard the loud rushing as of a strong wind going around the house. And then all was quiet. There was no more disturbance from the malignant ghost. And the next morning they went outside and they found patches of blood on the ground. And they said what had happened was the Wadawaino had come and destroyed this malignant ghost. The point, a family has a Wadawaino, an ancestral protecting spirit, only as long as the family retains the family land. If you sell the land, the Wadawaino disappears. It protects and guards the family only insofar as they maintain ownership of their land. Again, then, this participation with the land, the sense that a land is really part of the family, and if it's gone, then there's something very significant that is missing from that family. It's no longer a family in the same way. It no longer has this ghost. Well, all right. Land is a very important part, then, of this mana, this participation or intermingling of external reality with the self. Another example is a kinship group. The Maori are organized in descent groups. They're not quite unilineal lineages like we've talked about. I won't really go into the intricacies of it, but at least they do have descent groups that they live in. And often a Maori will refer to his descent group by the first person singular, by the word I, so that if a battle took place 150 years ago and the person he's telling you about, if his ancestors were victorious, he might very well say, 150 years ago, I defeated such and such. I defeated such and such a group. Referring then to his ancestors as I. Again, the notion is that a part of the Maori is his relatives, not only those contemporaneous with him, but those who lived long before, and indeed those who are yet to come. And that there is then this mingling of personalities among kinsmen. They form, in a sense, one very large personality. Okay, well, you have all of these permeations going on of the self to the outside to the self. And as I said before, if you want to get along in life, if you want, in other words, to keep your tupu increasing, or to keep your tupu, that's redundant, tupu is increasing. So if you want to keep your tupu, we're going to avoid mata. What you need to do is to bring yourself in contact with those external influences, that mana, which will strengthen you and keep out that mana or those influences which will weaken you. So there's a there's a whole notion of control involved here. Very, very important to Maori worldview. A notion that you have got to control your relationships to the outside world. And here we come to another term which you are familiar with already from our own language, which if you spell it properly, or the way that Maori say it in a way, it's tapu, although of course we tend to say taboo, but it's the same kind of a concept. Tapu is a way of maintaining, of controlling your relationship to the outside world. Bring the good stuff in to keep the bad stuff out. One way that this is done is in ritual. Now, the Maori have a notion of great gods, Tane, that we've already talked about, and a number of others, Rangi and Papa and so on. And every now and then they have rites, rituals, where they have ceremonies to propitiate these gods and to get these gods to help in the affairs of daily life. If, for example, you are planting crops, you have a right to have the gods help make the crops fertile. If you are harvesting, you have a right of giving the first fruits of your harvest to the gods as a means of thanks for their assistance. If you're going to go to war, you have a right to enlist the help of the gods so that your enterprise will be successful. In fact, for the Polynesian, no enterprise, especially no military enterprise, could be successful unless you had divine assistance. So you have a series of activities in the ceremonial center where you, among other things, you awaken the god, and then bring the god into contact with man in order, as it were, to open up the channel or the flow of divine mana, of divine strength, so that it can be used for the benefit of mankind. But it's a very dangerous situation, and this is the point that I want to stress. Divine mana is a rough analogy might be electricity, where the right amount of it is good, but too much of it is very, very detrimental. As bad is not enough. So that when they have a right, it is necessary that they control very carefully the amount of influence from the god which they receive. Because if you run the risk of opening the channel in an unguarded way so that a tremendous surcharge or rush of mana can come in and can cause a lot of havoc and a lot of harm to the people who are engaging in the rite. In Tahiti, for example, when a rite was being held, it was necessary that everybody in the village stay in their house. Everybody who was not at the ceremonial center engaging in the rite, stay in their house, be absolutely silent, no dog may bark, no fire may be lit, nothing can be done because there is this divine presence all around, and if people do things like carrying on daily activities or act frivolous or something, this can kind of click the divine presence into an overcharge that can come rushing into the village and can start, you know, people will die and all kinds of disasters will happen. Incidentally, when the Tahitians converted to Christianity, they were really excellent keepers of the Sabbath. The missionaries, they had a very hard time inculcating into the Tahitians a sense of sin. They still can't pull that off very well, but they at least have been very pleased with the way the Tahitians would keep the Sabbath. They wouldn't work on the Sabbath. They wouldn't, do anything that they weren't supposed to. And the missionary says, wow, that's really great. We've got these people understanding the Christian message. Well, you know, really all it was just carrying over from the tapu that was associated with the ancient rites, bringing that into the Christian Sabbath. Well, okay, you have then this careful control at a major rite in order to be sure that you get the right amount of mana and not too much. Again, there are various kinds of rites that you can engage in, simple little ones really, little acts, which will enable you to receive influence from the outside when you need it. One of the most interesting of these is the rites associated with the latrine. Now, the Maori had at the edge of the village, had a latrine, which everybody used, which was basically a long horizontal bar over which people would squat and eliminate. Now, if a Maori felt that he was weak, that mate was upon him, and he needed kind of a shot of energy or influence or power from the outside, he would go and he would bite the bar of the latrine. That's true. And in so doing, this would strengthen him. Now, I said that the head is the seat of a person's tupu, and that's right, but another part of the body, which is very imbued with power and strength, is the penis. And the bar of the latrine, of course, is something with which many penises have come in contact. And therefore, if you want to get some of that strength for yourself, you go and you bite the bar, and this will allow some of that mana to flow into you. So you see, it's not only your relation with the gods, but really your relation with other people, where by doing this you can get strength and vitality from other men, and it can strengthen you, it can increase your own tupu. Again, to carry on the story of the penis, before going on to war, a Maori army would, well, the war chief would stand on two sort of mounds of earth, like this, and then all of his warriors would pass between his legs in a little, you know, single file line, thus coming under or rushing against his penis, and thus each of the warriors would receive from the war chief, who was the bravest and the strongest of them all, would receive this kind of power. Or again, the Maori were very taken with the notion that the Europeans keep chamber pots in their rooms. In the 1860s, 1870s, in that period, there were Maori wars in New Zealand where the whites were kind of taking over some land, and the Maori were resisting this, and you had some very powerful, very large battles and all kinds of wars, not unlike our own Indian wars. The Maori were a very powerful foe to the British. They also had senses of honor and proper conduct of battles and so on. For example, in one battle, the Europeans who were fighting in it ran out of ammunition. And so the Maori pulled up a white flag and had a little truce, and they said, wait a minute, and they brought over a few boxes of ammunition to the Europeans. And they said, okay, let's carry on. So they, you know, they had these ideas of honor and war and so on. But they found that the British were very worthy opponents, and ultimately, of course, the British won. And a Maori noticed that in a European house, the guy kept a chamber pot under his bed. They said, that's why you're so brave on the battlefield and so effective in fighting, because you keep your urine near you. And in that way, the power, the mana, the influence of urine from the penis is kind of, you know, permeating you while you're sleeping and strengthening you, building up your tupu, making you then more powerful, more effective in war. Another example. What happens is, because of this notion that there are influences coming into you from the outside, well, let me try this one first. Now, the things that I've been talking about so far are beneficial. Biting the bar of the latrine, passing between the chief's legs, and so on. But detrimental influences can happen to you also in very similar ways. One day, I was just reading yesterday, there was a Maori chief, high chief, who had lost his tinder box, which he used to, you know, light sparks in order to light his pipe. Now, some commoner men found it. And they decided, you know, they had pipes too, and so they, well, let's light our pipes. And so they lit their pipes with the tinderbox, not knowing to whom it belonged. And they found out later on that the tinderbox was the property of this high chief. And very quickly, the commoners who had used it died. The notion being that the mana which inhered in the tinderbox as a possession of the chief was of a quality or a quantity which was far greater and finer than anything that a commoner could stand. And as such, the very use of a chief's tinderbox was enough to give this tremendous overcharge of mana that I've been talking about before into these commoners, and thus to kill them. So you have, you know, these influences coming from the outside, which can be lethal as well as building up. You know, too much of a good thing is as bad as not enough of a good thing. Because of this permeation of the self with other people and all of these influences flowing around, a Maori can be thought of as having kind of a sphere of influence, if you will, so that around a person, not only physically, but in his activities and so on, there is a certain area which is under his control, as it were. Just as he is receiving influences from the outside, so he is putting out influences to the outside, and therefore, a person who is strong, a person who has really got to move, is going to have an effect and have a control over a kind of a sphere of influence around him. The head of a family will have it around his family members and his own land and his own household. A chief will have it over all of the people who are his retainers and his followers, and so on. The Māori had a notion that a person is really responsible for what happens within what should be his sphere of influence. There is a custom called the huru. It goes this way. Say that you're a man who has married and has a child, and you're away on a trip or something like that, but while you're gone, your child falls into a fire and burns himself. Now, the notion is that that's your fault as the father of the child, because that child should be sort of protected by the umbrella of your tupu or your mana, should be protected because he's within your sphere of influence. And insofar as some disaster or some accident befalls that child, it's your fault, even if you're away visiting somewhere else, because it means that your psychic power was not enough to protect him. So the child's mother's family, your wife's brother, your wife's father, will come swooping down on your household, and this is what the mudu is, come swooping down on your household, tear down your house, destroy your possessions, steal things, and kind of cause a lot of trouble in general, against which you cannot legitimately raise any retaliation. Because all they are doing is taking revenge on you for your failing, because they have an interest in that child too. He's their relative. They have, in a sense, said, okay, this is our relative, but we're putting him in your care, under your influence, and insofar as you can't control that and can't protect the child, you are at fault, and now we are going to exact retribution. The sense, then, that there is this sphere of influence around each person within which he should have control. And it's a sphere that, of course, extends well beyond, then, his own body. You see this again, and very interestingly, really, in the way that Maori fight and the construction that they put on a battle, combat, especially between two people, individual combat. Because what you have overtly is clubs and knives and spears and so on being wielded against each other with an attempt to kill the other. But what is really going on, and what is most importantly going on, is a battle of wills. It's as if these two spheres of influence, or if you will, these two force fields, are sort of coming into contact with one another, and each one is trying to overwhelm the other. I will your death, and you will mine. And these two wills are conflicting as we fight. And as the battle goes on, one of those wills is getting stronger and stronger and driving out the other will, or overwhelming the other will, with a sort of penetration of influence, of force, of mana. So that, say, you're going to win it, I'm going to die. It means that ultimately, the will which is dominating both of us, as we get to the end of our battle, the will which is dominating both of us is the will of my death. So that my will for my preservation and your death has been driven out by the superior strength of your will for my death. And so ultimately, we both are overwhelmed, are included within the desire for my death, and at that time I die. You kill me. I'm no longer able to resist, to defend myself, and I'm dead. But it's very much this notion of two wills, two spheres of influence, attempting to overwhelm each other. And the physical fight is just sort of an epiphenomenon, sort of something that goes along in the tangible world, but really isn't all that important. Okay. Now let me talk a little bit about how some of these things, these concepts of mana and tupu and tapu and so on, work themselves out in Maori culture. For one thing, the Maori are a people who are stratified. They have a ranking system in their society. I've talked about high chiefs and commoners and so on. And part of the rationale or basis behind the system of rank is really this concept of tupu. Because, as I've said, tupu is your inherent potential to become something, like the plant, its seed, has its potential to become a certain sort of plant. Now, high-ranking people have got a kind of a tupu, a potential, with which they are born, which is just very different from low-ranking people. So that, if you were born high-ranking, you have the potential to become a great person, a powerful person, an influential person. If you are born to a low rank, to a commoner family, you just don't have that potential. You're not made of that stuff. And a maple seed will never become an oak. A commoner can never become a great man. And that, in the Maori point of view, is just simply the way it is. So the notion of rank is a very fixed and rigid system, where each person has a certain amount of tupu, and that's all that he can realize and no more. It's possible, of course, that a high-ranking person may not realize his tupu, that things can happen to affect it and diminish it and so on, but a commoner can never do great things in the Maori view because of he just does not have that stuff. He's not made of the same tupu. Again, and now we start to come back to this chart, the difference between male and female, between man and woman, can be seen also and understood a little bit in this concept of tupu. They just are different kinds of beings, men and women. Men are associated with the sky, with rangi, with tane, with the gods who live in the upper world, with light, with life, with things of that sort. Women, on the other hand, come from, you recall this woman I talked about, Hine Ahuone, the woman made of the earth. She was actually formed out of earth or out of sand. That was the beginning of women, and from her, so that the women have this association with the earth, with darkness, with the underworld, with death. The personification of death, as you recall, is this woman, Hine Nui Te Po, the great woman of the darkness, who lives in the underworld. All of these associations of women with earth, underworld, darkness, death, and so on. Now, this means that the nature or the character of male and female are basically different, but they're different in a very interesting way. In the first place, the male is very pure, and the female is kind of impure. The male is fine and high and strong, and the female is much more rough and stuff. But that has an interesting component to it, which is that the male, with all of his purity and all of his fineness and all of his strength, is also terribly delicate. This is a being which must very carefully protect himself from all kinds of extraneous influences because he is very vulnerable to them. High and mighty and fine and intricately formed as he is, he can be very easily broken, be very easily brought down. And so the male has to be particularly careful about his contact with the external world because the mana of the outside can really hurt him. The woman, on the other hand, rude and common and low, though she is in a way, I don't mean by low evil, the good evil is not in this at all, but just earthy and stuff like that. Although she is all of those things, not nearly the fineness of the male, she is also far more robust. She is not vulnerable to external influences. She is, in a way, she is stronger because she is not subject to the kind of detriments and destructions and injuries from external mana that the man is. So a woman is really safer in life than a man is. It's as if the point is that a woman is a mixture, and a mixture can receive more things into it than a pure substance, and as such the mixture is more robust, stronger. This is, I'll read you a quote or two about this from this book by Johansson. Woman is descended from earth, as first woman was formed of earth. Earth is not pure, unmixed, isolated, since all kinds of people and things tread upon it. Nor is woman's life pure and unmixed, since she cooks food to be eaten by many different persons. She is closer to daily life, to interaction of all kinds of people and things, than man. And now this gets very interesting, so listen here. Woman and the earth are not so much the representatives of death as those of the mixture of life, but they become representatives of death because the pollution or the mixture of life is the great source of misfortune and death, all that to which the Maori is inherent in fate. that which compels man from without, the samana stuff. It is probably impossible to tell whether the Maori had a feeling that there is something sterile about life in the male, for the very reason of its purity, or that the fertility of woman and the mixture of life are necessarily associated, or whether he just accepted the fact that it is the woman who bears children. At any rate, the man possesses life, and the woman multiplies it, but at the same time, she introduces death into it. Now, a lot of this worldview is kind of modeled on the notion of sexual intercourse. And it's very interesting how they see this as really a microcosm of life and death and just the human condition in general. It's a battle between male and female, a battle which always ends in the defeat of the male, in the sense that there is loss of erection. Now, Johansson says this: there is something profoundly characteristic of the Maori in this, in his modeling of the existence on sexual intercourse, not only in the degree in which he experiences with his body, but also in the fact that he feels the tense activity as the true expression of life, matatupu, and that the relaxation, the loss of erection and so on, is experienced as defeat or mate. So that in sexual intercourse, and particularly for the male, where you have erection followed by loss of erection, you have tupu followed by mate. This is no doubt associated inextricably with the Maori's whole view of man and woman, that woman actualizes man's life, but that, bringing forth life, she imbues it with defeat and death. Now, that brings me back to now some of these oppositions that I was talking about before, at the very beginning. The point is that the oppositions here are not oppositions in the sense that we think of them in a Christian context. We have good and evil, light and dark, where there is a battle between the forces of light and the forces of darkness, and we all hope and pray fervently that someday light will overcome darkness and everything will, you know, the oppositions will be ended and the good side will win. Maori duality is not that way at all. It is a complementary duality where nothing can exist without its opposite. There can be no light without darkness, and most especially there can be no light without death. These two things are associated with one another. They are mutually dependent upon each other. So that woman who brings forth life, who bears children, also is the personification of death. And you remember the story of Maui, who died trying to give man eternal life, and he died in the womb of death. So that the same organs, the same processes of birth are associated with death. The vagina is called by the Maori a passage of death. So that life and death become almost one and the same thing, or at least mutually dependent one upon the other. There's another point that needs to be made about this dualism, and that is that they are mutually dependent and also they must be controlled. This notion of control is tremendously significant in Maori worldview. I talked about it in terms of tapu. You've got to control your relation to the outside world and so on. Look again at the myth of Rangi and Papa, the initial parents, the sky father and the earth mother. They were at the beginning, as you recall, locked in sexual intercourse. But the life-giving act, and in fact, it was the act from which the gods sprang. If they gave birth to Tane, who in turn was the father of mankind and everything else in the world. So all of life and all of existence springs from this initial copulation of Rangi and Papa. But the only way that life could go on is to separate them. That's very significant. The life-giving act, in order for there to be life, must be curtailed. They had to be separated. Their life could not be carried on the earth when they were locked together because nobody could stand upright. In other words, the creative act is only truly creative and fully creative when it is controlled. And so for the Maori, when you have the meeting of these opposites, which are mutually attracting, they have to be controlled. This all has to take place in controlled circumstances. And only then can you have indeed fertility and life and so on. So it's a very complicated sort of a context of mutually attracting opposites which need to be controlled and which sort of blend what seem to us contradictions into unities of life and death and light and dark, so on and so forth. And one, then, very quick, final point. A lot of the responsibility for cosmic control lies with man. In the rites to the high gods and so on, it is man who is responsible for bringing the influence of the gods down to this earth so that the crops will be fertile, so that the fish will run properly, and so on. A notion that mankind has the responsibility for the operation of the universe, a notion which we saw also in the American Indians, especially the Aztecs, who felt that they had to sacrifice large numbers of people in order that their god be given strength so that the world could continue in existence. There are people in this world who feel that they have the responsibility to keep the existence of the universe going. And in our Judeo-Christian tradition, or in our scientific tradition, we don't think that very much, except now that we feel we have the capacity to destroy life, and then we get worried about that and have that responsibility. But otherwise, the world kind of carries itself on. Just think to yourselves, I mean, what would it be like if you just were imbued with the whole notion that this world operates in its proper course because we, as human beings, make it operate that way? Some sort of a cosmic responsibility, which I think would have a lot to do with, the way you live. Okay, thank you very much.
So where is this Chinese monk? Where is it? So there are all the
Mary, Mary, quite contrary, how does your garden grow? With silver bells and cockle shells and one little onion in the middle. Jack, be nimble, Jack, be quick, Jack, jump over the candlestick.